Good afternoon, everyone. The Minnesota Senate Labor Committee will come to order. Today is Thursday, March 13th, 2025. And what we have on our agenda is Senate File 2373, the Department of Labor Appropriations Bill. And Chair McEwen is going to present that.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members, and I appreciate Senator Pappas, you stepping in to begin, start us off this afternoon. It's my pleasure, members, today to present Senate File 2373, the governor's proposed budget for the Labor Committee this year. It includes, in Article 1, a list of appropriations. The budget proposal maintains base funding and adds modest operating adjustments for the Department of Labor and Industry, the Bureau of Mediation Services, the Public Employment Relations Board, and the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals. It proposes new funding to the Labor Standards Division to enforce the existing misclassification laws with 2.5 FTEs. It also includes $5 million in the first year and $2 million in the second from the Workforce Development Fund to support the establishment of a statewide registered teacher apprenticeship program and joint apprenticeship training committee. And it extends the availability of the funding for the report on single stairways for apartment buildings through the report's due date in June 2026. In Article 2, the bill contains language on the proposed construction code and licensing fee adjustments to align with increased expense and inflation, since many of these fees have, in fact, not been adjusted since between the years 2005 and 2013, so it's been some time. The bill also makes some construction code policy changes that we will perhaps hear more about from the commissioner and in testimony. Article 3 of the bill includes a proposal to clarify our existing break laws and enact remedies for workers who are denied their rights to these breaks. This bill will need to go to the Judiciary Committee before it comes back to us to build our committee's omnibus, so I would like to move the A2 amendment, which would add the language from the policy bill we heard on Tuesday, some of that language that also needs to be heard in the Judiciary Committee. But with that, I look forward to the testimony and our discussion of this proposed budget today. Thank you, but I would like to move that A2.
Thank you, Senator McEwen. So Senator McEwen moves the A2 amendment. Any discussion? Okay, those in favor of the A2 say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Nay. The A2 amendment is adopted. And we'll move to testimony, I believe, unless you had anything to add, Senator McEwen.
No, not at this time. Great. Thank you.
So we will have Nicole Blitzenbach, the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nicole Blitzenbach and I serve as the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. Thank you for the opportunity to present the governor's proposed budget for the Department of Labor and Industry and to testify in support of Senate File 2373. So I will quickly go over the different proposals that relate to the department, including the construction codes and licensing fee alignment, the misclassification enforcement funding, the statewide teacher registered apprenticeship proposal, the operating adjustment, the proposal to strengthen mandatory break laws, as well as the proposal to extend the funding for the single egress stairway report. So I'll start out by going over the proposal related to construction codes and licensing fee alignment. So the governor recommends in this proposal to align permit inspection, plan review, and registration fees for 6 different units in the construction codes and licensing division to align that with the cost of providing the service. The construction codes and licensing division is funded exclusively by revenue generated from fees that are charged for the services provided. Currently, the fees that we assess are inadequate to fund the costs of providing services due to inflationary and cost increases. As was mentioned by Chair McEwen, fees have generally not been increased since 2007, which is when the division was formed within the department. I do want to draw the members' attention to the letters that have been submitted in support of this provision. In the packets, there are letters from a joint letter from the IBEW State Council and NECA, a joint letter from MMCA and the Minnesota Pipe Trades Association, a letter from Housing First, a letter from the Minnesota State Building and Construction Trades Council, and a letter from the Elevator Constructors Local 9. All of those letters are in support of this proposal. Also in your packets, you will find a summary of the fee proposal and how it affects each different unit within our division. So on the next slide, I'll have this up on the screen. I'm not going to talk about all of it in depth, but you'll see how the fee proposal affects the fees for electrical permits, for plumbing plan review and permit fees. I do want to highlight just one thing related to electrical permit fees. One of the fees there is new, and that's the virtual inspection fee. And this is just one example of how our innovation has allowed for some savings in what we charge for some of the services. So our virtual inspections allow contractors to book an inspection in a 15-minute window. Those virtual inspections can be completed while the contractor is still on site, and contractors save time and money, and the state saves time and money, so no inspector drive time, gas, and vehicle costs. So this has been a really great addition to the work that we and the service we are able to provide through our electrical unit. So that just wanted to highlight that. Next, you'll see we have the proposed changes to our manufactured structures unit, our boiler inspection fees, and our elevator inspection fees. I do want to point out, and I believe you'll hear from the Manufactured and Modular Home Association later, they are signed up to testify, that they do have some concerns. We are aware of those concerns with this proposal, and we will continue to work with them to address the concerns, and we expect those conversations will continue, and hopefully we can get to a mutual agreement on how those fees will need to be changed. All right, so moving on to the next item in the budget proposal is a recommendation for funding for misclassification enforcement. So the governor recommends $281,000 in fiscal year 26 and $286,000 in fiscal year 27 to the department to increase funding for enforcement of worker misclassification laws. This would be the equivalent of 2.5 FTEs in our labor standards division. I just want to say thank you to the AGC of Minnesota for submitting a letter in support of this ask. We appreciate their partnership and understand that their understanding that misclassification hurts businesses who comply with the law. We especially see this in the construction industry. So we are optimistic that with the tools and these additional resources that we can help level the playing field for those contractors. The next slide, for those of you that were here when the Misclassification Partnership did their presentation to the committee, so this is a slide from that presentation, but I did just want to highlight the increase in the volume of misclassification complaints that have come into the department. So you'll see we've received 26 more intakes in the past 7 months than in all of 2023. In looking at those totals. So just goes to show that the additional resources really are necessary for us to address misclassification in many different industries. We've seen complaints come in from the mental health and substance abuse industry, healthcare, construction, transportation, restaurant, food service. So this is not an issue that is limited to one industry, and we know that we need additional resources to address it. Moving on, statewide registered teacher apprenticeship. So the proposal there is $5 million in fiscal year 26 and $2 million in fiscal year 27 from the Workforce Development Fund to support the establishment of a statewide registered apprenticeship program for teachers. So in this proposal, it's structured as a grant to a labor organization representing educators to establish a statewide registered apprenticeship program. The main goal here is to have a registered apprenticeship program that can partner with districts anywhere in the state. From Moorhead to Winona, anybody can participate. Operationalizing this program includes setting up a joint apprenticeship training committee. More details on a further slide of why this is important. It would allow for sub-awards to signatory school districts that would offset costs to participate in the program and can be used for apprentice tuition, scholarships, supportive services for up to 24 months. It would allow for journey worker teacher stipends for each apprentice that is mentored during the school year. The statewide approach, like I said, would allow this to be utilized where the needs arise across the state. The program would require 6,000 hours of on-the-job learning and at least 144 hours of related classroom instruction that each year provided by the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board approved teacher preparation providers. The training would result in a Tier 3 license. There are three programs that are currently registered in Minnesota, three registered apprenticeship programs for teachers, but a statewide approach allows us to promote consistency and ease of administration. The development and approval of each registered teacher apprenticeship program requires a significant amount of coordination between the Department of Labor and Industry, the Minnesota Department of Education, and PELSBY, as well as coordination between school districts, local unions, and teacher prep providers. Presently, the program development process for each registered teacher apprenticeship program takes approximately 18 months. Multiple school districts across the state have expressed an interest in registered teacher apprenticeship programs, but have indicated they lack the resources to successfully register and maintain a single employer program. So a program that can serve these school districts across the state provides increased capacity and program sustainability for school districts and ensures a more standardized, high-quality experience for apprentices. I do want to point out that a statewide approach will not impact current programs that are already existing, nor will it preclude other school districts or charter schools from pursuing their own programs or seeking other state and federal apprenticeship resources. And we often receive the question about why this money would go through the Department of Labor and Industry rather than the Department of Education. So I have this slide that just talks a little bit about Apprenticeship Minnesota. So we are at the Department of Labor and Industry, serves as the role as the state apprenticeship agency. And so we regulate and help develop new programs. We manage and oversee existing programs to ensure that they adhere to the law and the regulations. And because we are the agency that helps do that, it makes sense for funding to come through our agency as well. And just a little bit more background on registered apprenticeship and why, and I know the committee also heard a whole session on registered apprenticeship and why it's been so successful. But there are three types of entities that are eligible to administer registered apprenticeship programs: employers, employer associations, and apprenticeship committees. Apprenticeship programs that have a unionized workforce and a statewide reach would use an apprenticeship committee model known as a joint apprenticeship training committee. JATCs have equal representation from employers and employees and are responsible for running the apprenticeship program. They have more than 80 years of demonstrated success in Minnesota, and I also wanted to point out that Oregon and Washington have successfully implemented this model for teacher apprenticeships that we are proposing. Okay, moving on to the operating adjustment asks. There are two operating adjustments included in this proposal. The first is an operating adjustment to our general fund money. That includes additional funding of $144,000 in fiscal year 26 and $292,000 each year thereafter. This was done in consultation with MMB and addresses inflationary cost increase. The Workers' Compensation Fund, we are also asking for an operating adjustment, and this additional funding would be $1.884 million in fiscal year 26 and $2.194 million each year thereafter. This would be to address inflationary costs, but also would support the Workers' Compensation Division by fully funding the existing FTEs in the division, increasing funding available for the statutorily required medical consultant position, as well as replenishing IT staffing resources. I should note we have brought that funding proposal up to members of the Work Comp Advisory Council, and we have not heard any concerns or opposition. I don't want to say that we've got letters of support because we don't, but we haven't heard any concerns or opposition to that. And the other thing we did do when asking for this was look at the Work Comp Fund, which is funded through assessments on insurers, and this ask will not have an impact on the assessments that are currently that we currently have to the work comp insurers. Next is the proposal to strengthen mandatory break laws. The governor recommends updating the work and meal break laws to clarify employees' rights and employers' obligations under these laws. Current rest break language requires adequate time to use the nearest restroom for every 4 consecutive hours worked. So what the proposal does is really tries to clarify what that means. And it would update it to be 15 minutes or enough time to use the restroom for every 4 consecutive hours worked. Current meal break language requires sufficient time to eat a meal for every 8 consecutive hours worked. And this proposal would update that to require a 30-minute meal break for every 6 consecutive hours worked. This is really more of a clarification for employers to understand that we get a lot of questions at the department about, well, what is the requirement for break time? And the response is, well, you need to provide enough time for people to use the nearest restroom. And then the question we get back is, well, what does that mean? And so this would give more clarification to both the employees and the employers that 15 minutes is the appropriate break time. It may be more if you're further away from a restroom than 15 minutes, but 15 minutes is that minimum, and that 30 minutes is the minimum for the meal break. I will say this does come a little more, put us more in conformity with what the federal requirements are. It's very clear through case law that has been established that if an employer provides a meal break of less than 30 minutes, that it must be compensated time. So when you talk to employers out there, most employers do provide 15-minute breaks and 30-minute meal times. I also want to just mention that current law and the language as proposed would not put significant limits on an employer's ability to require their employees to take those breaks at certain times. The only timing requirements are that it be, if there are 6 consecutive hours, that you have the ability to eat a meal for the 30 minutes, and the 4 consecutive hours, the 15-minute break. Okay, moving on. And then the final item in the budget is the extension of the appropriation that we received to conduct the study into the single egress stairway report, to issue the report. The funding that we received will cancel prior to the time that the report is due. So we are asking that the funding that was allocated be extended through the time that the report is due so that we can finish that report and have the money to pay for the report as we've been directed to do. And I think that gets us to the end. And I will remain in committee for any questions, but thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any immediate questions? Otherwise, I think the plan is to Senator Wiesenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was promised 9 weeks ago to have a question answered, and I've still been waiting on a question. So this pertains to a meeting we had in the first week of session. So that's why I think it's pertinent to ask it right now. It's just a question I asked about how long we were waiting on permits for plumbing. I was told it's out about 7 weeks, and that was 9 weeks ago. I know from personal experience that I've been waiting at least 15 weeks for my plumbing permit. So can you tell me if that's been updated? Is it still at 7 weeks or is it 15 weeks? The person putting in the plumbing is still saying they're telling them about 14-ish weeks as well. So could you give us an update? Thank you.
Commissioner.
Chair and member, I would like to call up one of our, I'm guessing Greg Metz can come up and help with that answer.
Thank you so much. If you could just provide your name and title for the record and go ahead and answer the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Gregory Metz. I'm a state building official, work for the Department of Labor and Industry. Plumbing plan review is currently sitting at 6 weeks for plan review. To understand what plan review, what the time clock is that we look at is from the time a complete application is submitted to the department until a plan review is conducted on the permit. If there are deficiencies found in the plan review and corrections needed, that clock stops because we have no control over how long it takes for someone else to correct the documents for that. And then resubmittals are about, you know, correcting the work and ensuring that the work is compliant before we issue an approval.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that answer. There hasn't been any reissuance. We're just waiting on the plan. Actually, I know a few people that own plumbing industries and put in plumbing, and they're just being told it's about not 6 weeks. So thank you for that answer. No further questions.
Senator Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, question is for the commissioner. I got a letter from NFIB, and, you know, just the paragraph states their opposition to the mandatory break laws. And one of the reasons for their opposition is for small businesses that they represent about 10,000. They want to retain flexibility, require employees to take their breaks at specified times as outlined in employer policies and handbooks. Small employers need the ability to manage their workforce effectively. It is essential that proposed changes do not prevent employers from requiring breaks at set times or specifying employees may not stack breaks to leave early at the end of the workday. This flexibility is crucial for employers to maintain proper workplace operations and manage daily tasks effectively. I own a small business and I can relate to that to a certain degree, although I'm very flexible with my employees, to tell you the truth. And so is there any effort on Dolly's part to work with some of the concerns of NFIB, especially in relationship to small businesses?
Commissioner?
Chair and Senator Grunhagen, an employer can institute policies, rules, guidance as to when breaks can be taken and when rest breaks and when meal breaks can be taken. As long as the break happens within a consecutive 4-hour period or within under this proposal, consecutive 6-hour period for the meal break. There is nothing in this proposal that would limit the employer's ability to provide the break within those 4 hours or within those 6 hours.
Senator Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Chair. Yeah, thanks for that response. I just, you know, the state is just creeping in. You know, creeping in more and more to micromanage every aspect of almost everything a business does. And to me, it's one size fits all, and we've seen the pushback, especially in my district, and I know other people have, on the sick and safe time. One size fits all, that's the way it is. And, I hope you'll take some time and maybe talk to the governor, this is budget, to take those comments into consideration. I mean, I'm flexible with my employees, overly flexible probably, okay? And I just have, I won't get into the details on that, but I mean, I accommodate them in every way I can, and now we're coming, well, you got to take your break within this time and these many hours and that many hours. Well, it's the camel's nose under the tent. The next thing you know, we're going to be passing laws. You can only do it this 10 minutes or that 5 minutes. I mean, one thing about government, when they pass rules and regulations, it never seems to be enough. And the next thing you know, they impose consequences to it. And I think you know, not that there isn't problems out there, but you can't pass a law to solve every possible problem with a one-size-fits-all. Those are just my comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I think what we're going to try to do is get through some more testimony here, and then we'll still have time for more comments and questions. So with that, we're going to go to Melissa Hissing from the Minnesota AFL-CIO, and next after that, Alex Liuzzi with Education Minnesota.
Good afternoon, Chair and Committee members. My name is Melissa Hissing, and I'm Legislative Director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO. The state's labor federation, with over 1,000 local unions representing over 300,000 members in the public sector, private sector, and building trades. I'm here in support of Senate File 2373 and want to highlight our support for a couple of provisions of the bill. We support the increase in funding for DLI to enforce Minnesota's worker misclassification laws. When employers misclassify their workers as independent contractors, they deny those workers all of the rights and benefits associated with employment, including but not limited to minimum wage, overtime, unemployment insurance, workers' compensation, earned sick and safe time, paid leave, and collective bargaining rights. They gain an unfair advantage over other employers and avoid unemployment insurance premiums and taxes that fund the social safety net. This funding will help ensure DLI has the resources to handle increased complaints, to conduct complex investigations and enforcement, to protect workers, employers, and taxpayers. We also support strengthening mandatory break laws. Every worker needs to take breaks, but their right to do so is currently unclear under state law, leading to confusion for both workers and employers. Having a clear standard will help ensure every worker gets the meal and rest breaks they need to take care of their body and sustain their ability to do their job. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. And next up, please feel free to say your name and title for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Alex Liuzzi. I'm the Apprenticeship Coordinator at Education Minnesota. I'm here to speak in support of the appropriation of the Workforce Development Fund dollars to provide the capacity for a statewide sponsor to support districts in launching a registered teacher apprenticeship program. I've been working to develop apprenticeship programs for 2 years in Minnesota, initiating some of the first conversations in the state and helping launch the first approved teacher apprenticeship programs. I know firsthand the costs and capacity needed for this endeavor. I know that without the support of a statewide entity, many districts and their staff will not be able to benefit from the unique and transformative work of a registered teacher apprenticeship program. Many apprenticeship programs in other industries operate with the union as a sponsor of the program, including carpenters, pipe fitters, property service workers, roofers, boilers makers, plumbers, electrical trades, and more. The Department of Labor and Industries budget proposal for the use of the Workforce Development Fund dollars identifies labor unions as the place to build the statewide capacity and infrastructure within the industry of education. It is the union of the profession that can best provide the administration oversight and fidelity to apprenticeship program requirements for the state. Education Minnesota has and will continue to partner with districts and their local unions in personalizing apprenticeship programs to meet their specific local needs. We already support local unions and districts in negotiating the wage schedule and worker protections required in apprenticeship programs, as well as understanding the significant opportunities registered teacher apprenticeship programs can bring to their paraprofessionals and licensed teachers. So why are these funds needed? The Workforce Development Funds will allow the labor union of the profession to do many things. First, build and launch the Joint Teacher Apprenticeship or Joint Apprenticeship and Training Committee needed for the administration and oversight of all programs. This group has equal representation of district administrators and local union members. Second, provide districts, no matter their size or location, the funds needed for costs associated with operating apprenticeship programs, including stipends for journey teachers and navigators to support apprentices throughout the program. Third, provide apprentices all the supports that they need to be successful in a teacher preparation model that centers around on-the-job training. Fourth, expand the teacher apprenticeship program to new licensure areas in partnership with approved teacher preparation providers based on district needs across the state. These funds both create the infrastructure for a sustained and sustainable pathway for new teachers in the profession and also provide the immediate support for districts and apprentices to get started right away. This includes supporting the Elementary Licensure Teacher Apprenticeship Program created by Black Men Teach in Freedom Schools, a program you will hear from shortly, based in Hopkins and Robbinsdale Public Schools. We know we need to continue to innovate teacher preparation to not only increase the number of licensed teachers, but to also prepare those teachers in meaningful ways and support retention and practice-based skills. This pathway provides a new opportunity for many who have for years been committed to education and the students they serve, but have previously lacked the ability to access pathways for teacher preparation. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you so much. Next up, we have Paris Timmons, and after that, Kayana Thompson. Apologies for messing up your name if I did. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Paris Timmons. I am the Assistant Director of Extended and Experiential Learning and Academic Recovery, as well as the Executive Director for Freedom School and Hopkins Public Schools. I'm going to read Kiana Thompson's testimony first, as she was unable to be here, but she wrote her testimony out. Hello, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Kiana Thompson, and I am a supervisory paraprofessional at Hopkins Public Schools. I am writing to speak in support of the Workforce Development Fund dollars to support union sponsors in their work with districts in launching a registered teacher apprenticeship program. This program is going to do everything for my family and I. I didn't love the idea of going to school after high school to get into education because the pathway to get there wasn't appealing at the time. As I've worked in schools for the past 3 years and serving as a servant leader intern in the CDF Freedom Schools program in Hopkins Public Schools, this experience has ignited a passion that I didn't know I had. I get to show up not only for my scholars, but for myself. My daughter tells me how proud she is of me for going back to school and pursuing a passion to love, serve, and engage scholars in learning that will guide them on their pathway to success. This program, through a partnership with Bemidji State University as the related technical provider, will help our paraprofessionals like me gain a Tier 3 license and bachelor's degree after completing 3 years as an apprentice, a time in which we will be paid a livable wage as a paraprofessional and receive progressive wage increases, participate in CDF Freedom School summer programming, and receive support services from Black Men Teach, Education Minnesota, CDF Freedom Schools, and other partners, including Sancori and the Kitty Anderson Youth Science Center. Thank you for allowing me to speak. That was Kayla Thompson. As an educator, I get often asked by young scholars, by our youth, well, how'd you get into education? Why are you here? Why do you do this work for us? And my answer always stays the same. It remains constant. I do what I have to do because I do, I like to be who I needed to be when I was growing up. So for the same reasons that I got into education, this apprenticeship program, this work, is so, so, so impactful. When I started in education, I did not have this opportunity. One of the things that stands out the most is being able to still, for families that this, like Kiana, where she can still raise her kids, participate in extracurricular activities, working with adults, having on-the-job training, essentially, and most importantly, making a livable wage. When I think about my trajectory when I was looking into getting into education, I didn't have that opportunity in that I was doing unpaid internships. I wasn't doing on-the-job training. It was all in for school, and then your student teaching happened right when you were graduating. I think about how this real work experience is going to help prepare our future teachers better than any program that we have had before, because it allows us to be there from the very beginning. They're with scholars, they're with seasoned teachers, they're with organizations that serve scholars in ways that our teacher prep programs don't always do. It's an opportunity for them to ask questions along the way, to receive guidance along the way, in a way that keeps them grounded in the work because they're working with kids the whole time. I ask that you support this budget proposal, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Next, we have Tony Patterson, and after that, Ryan St. Cartier.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Tony Patterson. I am the Assistant Director of Achievement and Integration in Robbinsdale Area Schools. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of allocating Workforce Development Fund dollars to assist union sponsors in their efforts to establish a registered apprenticeship program. Our district is proud to collaborate with Education Minnesota to implement an innovative apprenticeship model that creates a sustainable pipeline of diverse, well-trained educators. Apprenticeship programs represent a unique partnership between employers and unions. In this particular apprenticeship program, over 20 educators of color collaborated with Black Men Teach and CDF Freedom Schools to create a program that supports paraprofessionals in becoming teachers. This program allows them to continue working with their students, avoid accruing debt, and not to leave their families at night for weekend courses. We have presented this opportunity to district leaders and local union representatives who are currently engaged in negotiations to establish a powerful memorandum of understanding. This agreement will firmly support both the apprentice and their mentor teachers. Additionally, the recruitment process is already underway. The development of a registered teacher apprenticeship program is a significant task. Our district would not have been able to participate without the support of the partner organization and Education Minnesota as a sponsor. Approving the allocation of these workforce development fund dollars will immediately support the launch and operations of our current apprenticeship program. Additionally, it will establish a foundation for Education Minnesota to offer this program to any district in the state, many of them which lack the capacity to design, implement, and oversee a registered apprenticeship program. Investing in education apprenticeships is an investment in Minnesota's future. We have the opportunity to cultivate our own teachers, create equitable access to the profession, and ensure every student, regardless of their background, has access to high-quality educators who believe in their success. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Patterson. And next we have Mr. Ryan St. Cartier. After that, Mark Bruner.
Good afternoon, Chair and Committee members. I'm Ryan St. Cartier, Government Affairs Director for the Minnesota Contractors of the National Electrical Contractors Association and the Minnesota Mechanical Contractors Association, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate File 2373. At Minnesota NECA and MMCA, we represent over 250 contractors who specialize in installation and maintenance of electrical, plumbing, heating, and cooling systems. Our members range from small businesses with just a few employees to large companies with hundreds. They take on construction and maintenance projects of all sizes in residential, commercial, and industrial sectors. On behalf of both associations, I'm here to voice support specifically for the Department of Labor and Industry Construction Code and Licensing Division's fee alignment and the adoption of Class 4 circuit technology into the Power Limited Technician License, which is a part of that fee alignment. It has been nearly 20 years since most of the licensing fees have been adjusted. Due to this, fees no longer align with the cost of services provided to contractors. This has led to an operational deficit in the Construction Code and Licensing Division. This operational deficit has created barriers for the division to accommodate a growing number of construction projects and inflationary cost pressures resulting in plan review and inspection service delays that impact our industry's ability to build on expected timelines. This harms contractors, workers, building owners, and consumers alike. The fee alignment will help our industry complete projects faster and therefore, in many cases, lower costs for my contractors and our customers. On Class 4 circuits, also known as fault-managed power systems, they're an emerging technology in the electrical industry that will increase safety for electricians and the public. They pose a near-zero risk of fire or electrical shock, but can still deliver thousands of watts suitable for high-power applications. They also bring a more affordable wiring solution for high-power applications. Class 4 systems, while still very safe, will require thorough inspections supported by the proposed electrical permit fees. My electrical contractors are eager to embrace this new technology through its adoption into the Power Limited license, and its benefits to the electrical industry and to the public are apparent. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next, we have Mr. Mark Bruner, and after that, Ryan Gilbertson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark Bruner, the Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee and the bill. Our association speaks for approximately 900 manufactured home communities in the state of Minnesota, as well as the plants that build manufactured and modular homes, along with the installers, the finance companies, mortgage companies. There are of the total number of manufactured homes that are sold annually, approximately 85% of all new manufactured homes are sited on real property, traditional foundations, financed with conventional financing, and many today underwritten by the GSEs, Fannie and Freddie. The remainder of the homes go on lease land in one of the 900 manufactured home communities throughout the state. There are approximately 14 plants that build manufactured and modular homes, four specifically build manufactured homes, the largest of which are in Redwood Falls, Montevideo, Red Lake Falls, Worthington, and Detroit Lakes. The association, for the most part, supports the fees being proposed in the bill. For example, the fee increase on the installation seal for manufactured homes being increased from $80 to $130. We're not opposed to that, in that it's been since, I think, 2008 since the department has increased that fee, and so we understand that costs have increased, and we are not opposed to that. Regarding the change in the hourly rate for plan reviews that mostly hits our modular plants, we're still waiting for some additional feedback from a couple of our modular builders on the increase, and we certainly understand that there will be. I'm just trying to get a better handle on that amount and if that's acceptable. The provision that would establish a new transportation fee in the bill of $75 for every manufactured home that's constructed in a plant in Minnesota or a plant outside of Minnesota. I mean, there are plants in Indiana, Wisconsin, Nebraska that build homes that come into the state. We have concerns about the fee being added on. First off, our concern just relates to the federal building code. All manufactured homes are built to a federal HUD code, which has a supremacy clause in that you can't make changes, alterations, add additional requirements to the home, whether it's a state or a municipality, which actually helps keeps the home more affordable. Imposing a requirement to transport a home, we think, may be problematic in that respect. And just simply, too, from the point of view, if you're a manufacturer building home, I mean, you're now going to have to add some additional software to start tracking a fee or a label that goes on a home for $75, and we're not really sure the purpose of that fee, how it would be enforced since it's going to go on the home. Would it be the state patrol that would be looking for this fee or for the label? In a conversation I had with the department earlier on how this would be enforced, they indicated that they would perhaps have somebody go out and physically check after the home has been installed to make sure that the seal had been fixed. So we're having conversations with the department on perhaps revisiting that fee and you know, hopefully we can make some progress with that. The a couple minor points that I'll visit later with the department on just a definition being proposed for manufactured home, we think needs to comport more with the federal statute or federal definition. However, our significant concern with the bill relates to what's called the used manufactured home resale decal that's going to be required for every manufactured home that's resold, you know, not new homes. And essentially what the bill does is replaces what's already in current law, and I did include in packets that were I believe handed out a copy of what's currently in place in the state building code, and that is a notice of compliance form that for any used manufactured home that's sold, there's a 9-point checklist that's completed. An agreement between the seller and the purchaser. It goes over items like smoke alarms, CO detectors, make sure it's got the correct furnace in the home, that kind of thing. So we worked on this language with the department. It's in statute, and just, you know, it requires that the buyer seller communicate who will make any of these corrections if that needs to be the case. What the bill would do is replace this and add, you know, several different requirements, and these homes then would have to be inspected by a building official to meet the new standards that are being proposed. The bill would establish a $1,200 fee so that, you know, for somebody living in you know, an area of the state where there's not a building official, which is about, you know, 80% of the state's landmass, the department would send someone out to inspect this used manufactured home. Albeit, these may be homes in a manufactured home community. There may be, what, you know, 50,000 there, but it's probably triple that in terms of on private property. So you'd have a large number of homes now suddenly needing to be inspected by the state, and not just exterior, but a physical walkthrough. And if there's a violation of any of the of these new requirements, you couldn't sell your home. And for homes in a manufactured home community, let's say it's a 1980 home, and it hasn't had much work done to it, improvements, it's had four owners, you'd be paying, hypothetically, the $1,200 to have somebody come inspect. You may be required to make upgrades to the home, things that you didn't do to the home as a change, but previous owners. So you could be looking at an additional $3,000-$4,000 that you may have to invest in your home to sell it. And if, you know, these older homes that are on leased land don't have the value of the land to bring the value up. So you're going to find homeowners are going to say, you know, for this amount, I just don't think we can do it. They'll sell the home for pennies on the dollar, and you'll have some unscrupulous contractor, someone come along and buy it at a low price, spend a few thousand dollars, flip it, resell it, and for some homeowners, this is going to be their only option in dealing with some additional costs. And ironically, if you look on the handout that I gave you and on the inside, this will apply to all manufactured homes, not homes that were built in the late 1970s that maybe need some work, but even to any new home on private property with a basement or a foundation, where the chances are that the owner of the home is not going to even know about the statute. They're not going to know that they're required to have this home inspected. You know, how would they know? I mean, they probably don't even know it's a manufactured home. So you have situations where they'll sell the home, a private sale, one owner to another. They'll go to closing with the title company, and the title company may say, well, do you have your inspection documents to show that this has been approved by the Department of Labor and Industry in meeting their code requirements? And you know, if that document's not there, the buyer and seller aren't aware of it, you aren't going to proceed with the closing. And the homes that we're building today, as I mentioned, are financed with conventional type mortgages. The plant in Redwood Falls produces the largest number of homes in the nation that are actually financed by Fannie Freddie's program. So you're not going to know that you're even dealing with a manufactured home, yet you're going to be required to have inspections, have your home physically walked through by someone. We've been talking to the department about this provision, and you know, we think we can make some progress on it to clean it up, but as it's drafted right now, it's problematic. Another provision that we have some concerns about would create a new licensure scheme for manufactured home salespeople. Right now, if you sell manufactured home as a licensed retailer or sales center, you have a license, you register your salespeople with the state. This would require a new licensing scheme, continuing education for the salespeople, and the specifics of that aren't outlined. And so we do have some concerns about that provision as well. There's also a new definition of a manufactured home dealer or sales center retailer that adds anyone who leases a home would now need to be required to become a full licensed sales center, hold that license, even though they don't sell homes. So if you own one of the 900 manufactured home communities and you have a home that you lease to a resident, based on the new definition, because you lease a home, you're now going to be required to have a sales license, which needs to be addressed separately as well. So we have a number of concerns, and honestly, this is the first time I've ever not testified in full support of a department bill, budget bill, and the first time we've had some concerns. So in one respect, I guess that's a good track record. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bruner. Appreciate your testimony, and we'll have time for questions later. Next, we'll have Ryan Gilbertson, and I believe this is the last testifier, so if anybody in the audience is planning to testify, we'll have a quick chance here after Mr. Gilbertson.
Chair Hochschild and members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Ryan Gilbertson, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota State Building and Construction Trades Council, representing over 70,000 skilled construction workers across our affiliate unions. We strongly support the Department of Labor and Industry's budget proposal because aligning fees with the cost of providing services like inspections, permitting, and plan reviews is essential to keep projects moving. When these services are underfunded, delays increase and uncertainty rises. That's bad for workers, bad for business, and bad for the Minnesota economy. A well-functioning system ensures predictability, allowing contractors to plan, workers to stay on the job, and projects to be completed safely and on time. A key piece of this legislation is stabilizing funding for the Construction Codes and Licensing Division. Essential services like electrical, boiler, plumbing, and elevator inspections have been running at a deficit. And if we don't address this now, it could lead to delays. The proposed fees adjustment are necessary. Many of these fees haven't changed since 2007, even as costs have risen. Ensuring CCLD has the resources it needs will help avoid costly backlogs and keep Minnesota's construction industry strong. At the end of this day, this bill is about keeping work moving, providing certainty for businesses and workers, and ensuring the safety and efficiency of our industry. Thank you for your time and attention. Please support Senate File 2373.
Thank you, Mr. Gilbertson. And with that, is there any other testimony in the audience? All right, seeing none, we will now move into discussion or questions. Senator Dornick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator McEwen, for the bill. I would like to have Commissioner Bliesenbach come up. I had a few questions. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you for the presentation. Appreciate it. Definitely the fees for, we know they're needed for the inspectors and all the work they do, and I can personally attest to the electrical inspectors. They do an outstanding job done lots of work throughout the years, and they are on the job, and they get there quickly. So don't have a problem with the fees, so appreciate that part. The one that is the most concerning is the one that you're talking about, so I appreciate the conversation that you're having with Mr. Bruner. But I just wanted to ask a few questions on the as I got the list here, it's got the shipment fee, the $75, resale decal fee of $100, salesperson license at $80 every 2 years, and then the plan review. Are these new fees, all of them? Because you talked about the first one, the install seal free fee increased of $80 to $100. So obviously that was an existing one. But are those other ones new?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dornick, I once again would like to call Greg Metz up to help explain some of the proposed fees.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, or Senator, sorry. So the shipment label fee and the resale decal fee are both new. The third fee and this salesperson's licensure is also a new program that we are working with Mr. Bruner and his organization to talk about those types of things. We're already looking at the high likelihood of striking the salesperson's license at this time, and we're discussing the other two fees right now.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that. I'm concerned with that is we're trying to make housing more affordable for people and the price point on these modular homes and are the lowest, right? And so I want to make sure that we're making those, not increasing the cost too much. The other question, I guess, maybe it's to you, Mr. Metz, is the form that you talked about with the 9-point checklist, if you could speak to that a little bit more and what your proposal or considering and why this one isn't working.
Mr. Chair and Senator, thank you for asking the question. The list that he was talking about is in your packet, and I think what you'll find is that the areas that we've expanded, we are still planning on discussing with Mr. Bruner and his group. The listing, if you go through it and you look at it, it really guarantees habitability of a manufactured home. Manufactured homes are initially designed very specifically from front to finish, and they're not intended to be remodeled by a homeowner because they are designed and engineered as a complete unit, which is why the criteria is more stringent for them. The listing here gets expanded to just ensure habitability for when a unit gets sold, that the items that are contained within are actually functional. Mr. Bruner mentioned that as an example, the furnace would need to be able to be listed. That is true, but the current list doesn't say that the furnace has to be operable and functioning. So we're adding that criteria in that the equipment actually needs to be operable and functioning. So if you go through the list, the plumbing has to work, the electrical system has to be installed so that there are fuses and circuit breakers, and that the switches and outlets are firmly attached to the walls. The furnaces work, the water heater works, they're vented correctly, that sort of thing. The intent of this already exists in statute in the form that you have in front of you. There is no current funding fee to enforce this in any way, shape, or form. So this has been subsidized by DLI, CCLD, through the construction fund to date. So what we are asking for is a resale decal fee to be associated with used home sales so that we can fund the auditing of this type of work, which we have been doing to date, but underfunded, so understaffed at this point. So we are continuing to do that work. We would like to expand that work in order to draw down the number of complaints that we have with regards to used home sales.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. So follow up with that. Tell me what the $1,200 that Mr. Bruner was talking about, that if you can share that. I wasn't quite sure of that, so if you could expand on that, it'd be great.
Mr. Chair, Senator, thank you again for the question. That's actually separate from the used home resale fee. Right now, if you install a manufactured home in outstate Minnesota in an area that doesn't have local code enforcement, which is a large part of the state, a homeowner has to contract with a private inspector in order to get that home inspected before they can occupy. Currently, the wait time for a private inspector to come out and inspect your home is anywhere between 4 and 8 months. Which is a long time to wait for a final inspection. This $1,200 inspection fee has nothing to do with used home resale. It has everything to do with the placement of a new home and making sure that they can get their final installation inspections in a timely manner. Why is it $1,200? It's $1,200 because we at CCLD did not want to undercut the private industry in their provision of the same services. We as government don't want to compete with them to provide the service, but we believe that we can provide the service in a timely manner. So we want to be an option out there that's available to provide a service so someone can occupy their home more quickly.
Mr. Chair.
Yep.
So I guess the last question, then I'll let others speak. So when you set a home, you're saying there's got to be an inspection. So what local entity does that? Are you saying it's strictly a private business that does that? Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair and Senator, when there is a local building official, the local building official will go out and make sure that the installation is correct so that the home is correctly has a correct anchorage to the ground so it doesn't blow over in a storm, that it's adequately skirted and the plumbing system is insulated so that the plumbing system as it connects to the ground and the site utilities doesn't freeze during the winter, that sort of thing.
Mr. Chair, one more. So the ones he had talked about that were 85% around private homes and then with a foundation, is that a different inspection from ones that are in trailer parks?
No. Mr. Chair, Senator, no, there's really no difference between first-time installation of a manufactured home on real estate versus first-time installation of a home within a manufactured home park. The application is the same, so they would either use the local building official for that work, or if they're located in an area that doesn't have a local building official, they would have to either hire a private inspector to come out and do that work on their behalf, or if this bill passes, we would be able to provide that service for them.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I appreciate your answers, and appreciate Commissioner Liesenbach for your willingness, and you're always open to work. So I look forward to working on this with Mr. Bruner and you and Senator McEwen. So thank you.
Senator Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, if Mark Bruner would come up to the testifying table. Be interrogated? No. Just kidding. Okay. Yeah, the question is, you know, I was listening to your testimony and some of your concerns. First question would be, are most of these prefabricated homes, are they purchased by first-time home buyers, a majority of them, or do you know the percentage?
Mr. Chair, Mark Bruner, Manufactured Modular Home Association Center. I don't know the percentage, but they are, you know, oftentimes, or you know, the first time home buyers. You know, we're seeing some changes with empty nesters, downsizing kind of thing. But yes, traditionally, first time home buyers, and they would even be more likely to. Go into a manufactured home community because they can't afford the land with the home, and you know, for a few years.
Thank you for that response. Yeah, because You know, we have a first-time home buyer crisis in the state, right? They can't afford new homes traditionally, and to me, this is a stepping stone for some of them. And, you know, we're increasing the cost in a number of areas of your concern, so I hope you can work something out in those areas, because government's good at artificially inflating the cost of things, okay? It's been my observation since I've been up here. The other thing about government I'll just state is, you know, it is so often spoken in government about the financial cost of inflation, but rarely do I hear in government the inflationary cost to the private sector, to people on fixed incomes, low-income people. They have just as big a consequence, if not more, than government. Some of them are choosing food, prescriptions, whether to pay the energy bill. I'm on the Energy Committee. We had a testimony, 36% of Minnesotans are struggling to pay their energy bill or not paying it at all, okay? That's where we're at. So the more we increase the cost, the less opportunity we provide for people to step into a home of themselves, for themselves. And, you know, just your testimony alone and a perusing of the bill, which I didn't get to read line by line, it just seems like, again, government is seeping in there, and the licensure, the additional fees, it's just going to continue to push the price of those things up and, in fact, create less access. I find your checklist to be pretty comprehensive, both in terms of the furnace, the water heater, and almost other area. Now, maybe it needs a little bit of tweaking, okay, which I could understand. But my concern about the bill again is we're just having government again micromanage to the point of driving up the cost. And here's my, and this is for everybody, including myself, you know, government needs to be a referee. You know, if you go to a football game, let's say, if there was no referee, well, we know how things would go, okay? You got to have a referee. You know, I played morning basketball for about 10 years in my hometown. We didn't have a referee, and one day a fist fight broke out, okay? So you do need a referee, I understand that. The problem with government, and it seems Minnesota has a real concern here, They should be the referee, but the referee wants to get into the huddle and call the plays, okay? And that's my real concern about so many things that have come before this committee in the last several years. What should be negotiated between an employer and employee, we do a one-size mandate fits all. You know, if you don't like your job, you don't like the conditions, guess what? Apply for a different job. The market's tight. So, I hope you're able to work some of these things out, because I see, again, government pushing up the price, and the result is your checklist might need a little critique, okay? I'm not against that, but I think some of the things in here is going to push up the price without a lot of results and make it more difficult for first-time home buyers to enter the market. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, other questions? Senator Wiesenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I probably have some questions for Mark as well. So you said, so what communities right now are currently manufacturing homes in Minnesota?
Let's see, we have Redwood Falls, Montevideo, Worthington, Red Lake Falls, Detroit Lakes. There is a modular plant in Otana, I believe Otsego. There may be Verndale. I think there are about 14 plants, and there are some very small ones, but the preponderance of the homes are built by probably 5 plants in the state.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess after listening to you talk, I guess my concern is, you know, if we implement this, the price of manufactured homes is now going to go up, and that could harm these communities. And maybe if there's less manufactured home sales, and some of these communities are going to be losing jobs. I went through some of this bill. I don't understand everything in here. There's like 40 pages and lots of amendments or underlined wording that would change things. Where we are in the state of Minnesota right now, it seems we should maybe just leave well enough alone and not be adding more undue burden onto people. And you know, if there's something that's majorly wrong, let's fix it. But this just seems like we're creating a problem and not a solution. So there were some other things I was going to ask, I think, but I guess I just wanted to find out that, you know, these are small communities. We don't want to be hurting people. And this might be for the other gentleman that was up here. I don't know if you know this, but, or maybe you would, but it sounded like if this bill would pass, and I might be wrong, I don't understand what I heard maybe when Senator Dornick was having the conversation. Is it a local building official that would have to inspect the home, or could it still be a private person?
Senator, to that question, it's, you know, most of the state, the landmass in Minnesota, is not covered by a local building official. And what we've been able to do when we worked out with a law change several years ago is to allow a municipality in a nearby community with city council approval to have their local building official go outside and do the work. Now, some municipalities don't want that liability of an employee going outside, and so that isn't the case. There are third-party inspectors that are approved by the Department of Labor and Industry that have the ability to, as a private company, to go do an inspection on a manufactured home or a modular home and certify that it does meet code. There are not, you know, a large number of them out there, but they do. So they're available. And then in areas where you don't have either option, you could contact the state, and that's where the $1,200 comes in. And in the case of a home that needs an inspection for the decal, my understanding would be where there's no local building official or private party available, that fee that you'd pay that same fee to have the home inspected. So one way or another, it would be inspected either by local or a local that contracts with the non-code area, a private, or the state. So one way or another, you're going to get your home inspected, I guess.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, and it sounds like you probably want to respond also. So it sounds like the answer is yes, we could still have a private inspector inspect, or not forcing it to be the government inspecting the home. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator.
I guess I just want to start with that and then move to the other things.
Yes. So new home placement requires an on-site inspection. So that either will happen with a local building official, if that's their jurisdiction when there is a local building official, or it will be by a private inspector.
Okay, yep, so that's good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just wanted to make sure we weren't forcing the government to do it. So it sounds like private people can still inspect. And then I saw you shake your head, so maybe there's something you wanted to say when he's speaking. Is there something you want to clarify, or?
Mr. Chair and Senator, the resale of a used home is not tied to the $1,200 new home placement inspection. So that resale, that $100 resale decal fee is to fund the auditing of that whole resale program and would include, if there are complaints, to go out to the site. It would fund the site visit, the review of the home to see if it complies with the resale criteria. If it doesn't, it could be corrected at that time, and then a decal could be assigned to the home.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I have a question for Senator McEwen.
Go ahead, Senator Weisenberg.
Did Department of Labor and Industry write this? Or I'm just curious where it came from. That's okay.
Senator McEwen. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Weisenberg. Yes, this is the department's budget bill, the administration's budget bill, and the plan then will be for this bill to go to Judiciary, where it has to review some of the enforcement provisions, and then the bill will come back to us, and we'll put together our omnibus bill. So there will be lots of opportunity. These discussions are ongoing, and as you know, we've heard some good faith efforts, I think, from everybody to try to figure out. Hammer out any differences that exist and try to come to a good place on that piece.
All right, thank you very much.
Senator Liske.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Senator McKeown. I'm sure you can already guess I'm not 100% in support of the bill. I do have some questions and maybe some of the things I support, some of the things I don't. But we brought up a great question, and I have a feeling the gentleman will be coming back up here that just went to sit down. my concerns are around, it sounds like the resale sticker thing is going to be an issue probably that you guys still need to work on. And when I listen to it and when I'm hearing it, what is the difference between a resale audit and an inspection when you're reselling any other house that's not modular?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Senator, the difference would be that existing homes, like stick-built homes, aren't required to have a home inspection. They also have the residential building code to comply with as far as the criteria for the standard for construction in the state of Minnesota. Manufactured homes are different. They have different rules, different criteria. So it's not the same code. Modifying manufactured homes is different. The purpose of the resale decal is not to evaluate the entire home and all of the criteria. It's to ensure that the minimum habitability of the home is met based on that criteria list that we submitted and modified.
Sorry, let's go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my other concern is, this opens a whole other can, in my opinion, a whole other can of worms, is there's houses that aren't modular homes that have that same issue that you're talking about, the inhabitability and things like that. And currently, we, like you just said, we can sell those houses without inspection. Do we not have concerns across the board? I don't understand why we're only targeting modular homes with this type of legislation.
Mr. Chair and Senator, the issue is that it's a manufactured home essentially is not able to be modified by a homeowner like a home is per Minnesota Rule 1309. They're highly specialized, they're highly engineered, they're built differently, they're very high quality in the way that they're built, but they're built very, very efficiently, which is part of the reason why they're as affordable as they are, because they do a phenomenal job manufacturing these in a factory. It also means that the criteria for the way that they're built tight, and there isn't a lot of tolerance built into these types of homes like there is in typical stick-built homes. That can be more readily modified.
Senator Liske.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that answer. I guess the thing that I get concerned about is that when we start legislating like this, we're basically telling people who own their own objects, own their own devices, that they can't do certain things to their own homes, their own whatever. And I'm a big property rights guy, so when you start telling people that they can't do something that they already own and can't modify, can't do these things, I understand what you're saying, right? Like there's concerns with structural components. There's concerns that if they do modify, it could, you know, change the integrity of a home. I think that argument could be made across the board. It doesn't matter which house you're talking about. And so I guess I understand that we already have those laws in place, and I don't know if I'm 100% on board with some of those things, too. I have questions about that now, but that's obviously for another day. But The issue that I have is that by putting this piece of legislation forward the way it is, it doesn't sound like the modular homes are going to succeed in some of the aspects, and they definitely don't support big parts of it. And something that I've heard for the last 2 years, now almost 3 years, is that we're constantly trying to find ways to make homes cheaper, make them more affordable. And by adding all these fees, all of these new regulations, that doesn't make homes cheaper. It makes them more expensive. And so I don't think we're achieving the goal by passing this legislation.
Care for a response, or are you?
Mr. Chair, thank you, and Senator. I guess I want to clarify that the resale decal does not go into all the ins and outs of what somebody may or may not have done with their property. It goes through the list of compliance criteria that's listed in the statute as the minimum habitability for the building. It talks to making sure that the furnaces work, the water heater works, the plumbing systems work. There are traps on plumbing fixtures so you don't have sewer gas coming into your unit. The furnace is vented to the outside rather than into an attic space or under the floor. All sorts of issues that we deal with complaints with used home sales on a regular basis. Right now, without a resale decal, we have no funding to do this, so we're having to take money from other areas, from the construction fund, in order to fund this effort through the unit. It cuts short our ability to staff the manufactured structures unit adequately in order to ensure that people are buying houses that meet the minimum criteria for habitability. I guess when we talked about, you were talking about affordability and affordability of fees, I think it's probably best to think about there are different pieces of the manufactured structures program. There are manufactured homes, there are modular homes, which are different. So manufactured homes are what you think of as sort of a mobile home, right? A modular home is something that's built in a factory custom and it's brought out to a site. So typically what we're talking about with the resale decal fee is a manufactured home. When we talked about the shipment label fee, yes, there are issues with the shipment label fee, and we need to work with Mr. Bruner to make sure that we get this to work. The idea behind the shipment label fee is that the smallest home that you would buy would have one floor. If you were buying a new home in Minnesota, you would have a placement label fee or an installation label fee of $130 as opposed to $80 what it is today, plus an additional $75 for the floor. That's for the smallest home. So the total fee for the installation of that would be $205. If you buy a double wide, now you have two floors and the fee goes up by $75. The idea behind the shipment label fee was to make sure that we keep the fees for the whole program for the new installation costs as low as possible for those first-time home buyers that are trying to get in and buy that first new home. So if we don't get the shipment label fee program approved, which it sounds like it may not be a great idea, and we'll work with you on that, we're probably looking at an installation fee of not $130, but $325.
So, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Bruner, you have a response to the question as well?
Yes, several. So the fee, no matter how you break it, if you apply, call it this part transportation fee, whatever, I mean, in the end, those costs all come together for the cost of the home. It really doesn't save the homeowner. Even though you're putting it on the builder of the home, they pass it on to the to the home buyer. So in the end, it all comes together. Relative to
manufactured homes being unique in some way, needing special attention. You can modify a manufactured home. You go to your local building official and you get approval for the design to add a third bedroom. They approve that, and as long as they approve it, there are no issues with the construction of that home. It's similar to what you would do with a modular home. You'd go to your local building official, you'd get your permit, they'd review your design, you'd put it on your home. So there really is no real disparity, and to equate this to a mobile home or a trailer is really unfair. You know, these homes are a part of the state building code. They're financed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. You know, to all of our customers who live in our homes, know they're safe. Relative to the current expense of this form, my understanding of the form is that this is between the buyer and the seller of the home, and so that this form, which we worked with on the department, is something that gets completed between the two parties. I didn't realize the department was involved in. And I'm wondering how that, where this cost is for the department.
Mr. Chair,
yep.
May I address a question? Thank
Go
you.
Ahead.
The cost gets involved is because when homeowners have problems with the list, they call us with complaints. And we follow up with those complaints. If it's the choice of the body that we don't have this program, we could not follow up with complaints. But then there's no recourse for homeowners that have homes that don't comply with the statutory criteria.
Senator McEwen.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. As much as I appreciate all of this discussion, and I think it is actually quite helpful for us to take a deeper dive sometimes, especially when we have a section of changes in an area with which many of us don't have a lot of familiarity, so I do sincerely appreciate the deeper dive. If we are comfortable moving on, members, you all do have my pledge that there are going to be continued talks on this, and I know that Senator Dornick has expressed interest also in helping with that, which I welcome. And as this bill moves along, we again will be accountable to all of you for the progress that we make in trying to come to agreement on this. And if there are members who would like to be involved in those discussions, please let me know and we can connect you as well.
I concur with Senator McEwen, but I do want to give a chance. Senator Kupek was on the list, and it has been a little while, so I want to make sure he gets a chance to ask any questions.
Sure, and actually, I'm going to have a totally different direction here. And we're going to move off modular homes here for a little bit. Actually, I have a couple of questions about the teacher apprentice program, so maybe somebody wants to come up about that. I'm a little fuzzy on a few things and just want a little clarification. Thank you, Mr. So, I understand the apprentice program for all the trades, and then I'm trying to just kind of wrap my head around what it means for a teacher when we know that that's kind of tied to a higher education program, and we already have like student teachers. Obviously, that's part of the requirement to get a teacher's license. So, who will be exactly in the teacher apprentice program? Are these college students? Are these, I heard, paraprofessionals? Are these people who are trying to move into teaching? I'm just kind of curious on this.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Senator Kupek, thank you for the question. And I really love talking about apprenticeship because it is such a proven model for success in so many industries, not just building and construction trades, although that is what most people are familiar with. But the apprentices who participate in the program could come from a number of different areas. It provides a pathway for a paraprofessional or an aide that may be interested in advancing their career and becoming a licensed teacher, but does not have the ability to proceed down a traditional pathway. But it could be a number of different people
who want to participate in the program. But really what sets it aside, or what makes it different than what a traditional teacher pathway would be, is that it has to comply with the requirements for a registered apprenticeship program, which are things like wage increases as the person progresses along the apprenticeship pathway. They would still have the, you know, earn as you learn model, but it would be partnered with the actual instruction. So you would have the college instruction, which is why it's so important for the program to also partner with teacher prep providers, like University of Minnesota or Mankato, or I think Bemidji was mentioned earlier. So you still have the prep provider involved, you have the school district involved, you have the Joint Apprenticeship Training Committee involved, and you really just have the involvement of the journey worker teacher also involved. But it's really this earn as you learn model that provides an additional pathway to people who may not be able to use the traditional pathway to teaching.
Senator Kupak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're really trying to capture maybe those people who, you know, who are not already, you know, enrolled in college, going on a you know, to become a teacher, but somebody who's like working in the school district, that this is their next step up, like a paraprofessional, that those would be, which would be good candidates to also become teachers because they're already committed to working within the school. So that's kind of who we're focusing on, just to be clear.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kupak, yes, correct.
Thank you.
Senator Grunhagen?
As long as we're on that issue, I kind of had a question too. Does, you know, I was on the school board for 16 years, so what? I kind of know how this works. Well, I just am reminding you. Anyway, so, you know, does, on this apprenticeship, this $5 million for apprentice for teacher, Do they have to complete it at the local level, and they actually have a graduate, and then submit for reimbursement, or do they get reimbursement right from the start? You follow my question?
Commissioner?
Yes, I believe so. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Grunhagen. So the funds could be used for a number of different things. It can be, they can be used to operationalize the program, to have that statewide reach, to design the related instruction, purchase training materials and apprenticeship tracking technology, recruit signatory school districts, journey worker teachers, apprentices. It would provide sub-awards to school districts who may need additional money, and that money could be used for apprentice tuition, scholarships, supportive services, and the stipends for the journey worker teachers. So the funding is really there to help set up the infrastructure of that statewide apprenticeship program, so that it is a program that school districts from all over the state can opt into and participate in, and the result is we have teachers, apprentices that become Tier 3 licensed teachers at the end.
Just real quick.
Senator Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for that response. Yeah, I would just recommend that they have to verify something was accomplished before you send the money. I mean, the school districts, well, they can do that, okay? And then they can reimburse you once something accomplished. I know how this works. If they're in the process and then the money comes in, you don't really have verification that it was completed, okay? And so that'd just be a suggestion. So, Mr. Chair, I think this bill needs a lot of work in a number of areas, and I would be more comfortable re-referring it without recommendation than to refer it with a recommendation, I guess.
Senator Dornick. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to go to a different direction, too. I was going to ask a question. Oh, Commissioner, you left. I think this is the money, and I'll wait till you get to your seat. So the on first page four, so I'm talking about the Workforce Development Fund for dual training, the money for the Workforce Development Fund for youth skills, Workforce Development Fund for administration. And then I go to the statute 175.46, and it talks about these standards are targeted for manufacturing, healthcare, services, information technology, and agriculture, and legal cannabis. So two questions. One is, do you have data for kind of where each, the number of participants in each one of those, and then also the cannabis industry? I'd like to hear a little bit about how that applies to and how they are navigated through into that and what they do. So it's page 4.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dornick, I believe that what you're reading from is the operating adjustment to our general fund appropriation. So that that operating adjustment was applied to each of our general fund appropriations to cover the increased costs. So we have currently, as part of our dual training program, a specific grant that was provided for the addition of a new industry in our dual training grant program, which was the legal cannabis industry that was added last year. As part of that grant and industry being added to the dual training program, we were provided with money for staff to make sure that those grants were that we worked with the employers who apply for those grants to establish the occupations and support the dual training, the employers that are the grant recipients, as well as the employees who are working through the dual training program. But that additional money right there, I believe, is part of the operating adjustment to our general fund appropriation.
Chair.
Yep.
So do we have an exact number for that, how much that was? Or is you're saying that's the amount that's here?
Go ahead, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I would have to look back at how much the initial appropriation was, but I may be able to ask some of my, if you let me check with my budget officer, I might be able to provide that for you.
It's okay if you want to do it later, that's too, it's fine.
Okay, I can definitely provide that amount of money that was provided for that dual training, the addition of the industry to the dual training program.
Thank you, we'll follow up with that. Thank you, Mr.
Okay, we will go to Senator McEwen.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and members, for a robust discussion today, and all of our members' interest in the various provisions of this bill. Again, this will come back to us, and we will have more opportunity for discussion. As we do, I invite all of you, of course, to engage with my office. Our door is always open. Would love to have your involvement as this bill makes its way through. So please don't hesitate to reach out if you want to talk about any of the provisions as it's moving forward. But with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to move that Senate File 2373 as a amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety.
Senator McEwen moves that we pass and recommend the legislation to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Is there any discussion? Okay. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Nay.
No.
The motion passes.
Thank you very much.
And with that, I believe we are adjourned.